So before leaving the microphone to Jamica Ajalon, whom I won't introduce in length because you all have her bio and the description of her performance on your knees, and she presents herself as best through what she will do. I would like to hand over the microphone to Joseph, who has agreed to read out the two pages that describe Giovanni's room in James Baldwin's novel. So we have some of his text with us. Thank you.
I scarcely know how to describe that room. It became, in a way, every room I had ever been in, and every room I find myself in hereafter will remind me of Giovanni's room. I did not really stay there very long. We met before the spring began, and I left there during the summer, but it still seems to me that I spent a lifetime there. Life in that room seemed to be occurring underwater. As I say, and it is certain that I underwent a sea change there. To begin with, the room was not large enough for two. It looked out onto a small courtyard. Looked out means only that the room had two windows against which the courtyard malevolently pressed, encroaching day by day as though it had confused itself with a jungle. We, or rather Giovanni, kept the windows closed most of the time. He had never brought any curtains. Neither did we buy any while I was in the room to ensure privacy. Giovanni had obscured the window panes with heavy white cleaning polish. We sometimes heard children playing outside our window. Sometimes strange shapes loomed against it. At such moments, Giovanni, working in the room or lying in bed, would stiffen like a hunting dog and remain perfectly still until whatever seemed to threaten our safety had moved away. He had always had great plans for remodeling the room, and before I arrived, he had already begun. One of the walls was a dirty, streaked white where he had torn off the wallpaper. The wall facing it was destined never to be uncovered, and on this wall, a lady in a hoop skirt and a man in knee breeches perpetually walked together, hemmed in by roses. The wallpaper lay on the floor, in great sheets and scrolls, in dust. On the floor also lay our dirty laundry, along with Giovanni's tools and the paintbrushes and the bottles of oil and turpentine. Our suitcases teetered on top of something, so that we dreaded ever having to open them, and sometimes went without some minor necessity, such as clean socks, for days. No one ever came to see us, except Jacques, and he did not come often. We were far from the center of the city, and we had no phone. I remember the first afternoon I woke up there, with Giovanni fast asleep beside me, heavy as a fallen rock. The sun filtered through the room so faintly that I was worried about the time. I stealthily lit a cigarette, for I did not want to wake Giovanni. I did not yet know I would face his eyes. I did not know how I would face his eyes. I looked about me. Giovanni had said something in the taxi about his room being very dirty. "I'm sure it is," I said lightly, and turned away from him, looking out the window. Then we had both been silent. When I woke up in his room, I remembered that there had been something strained and painful in the quality of that silence, which had been broken with when Giovanni said, with a shy, bitter smile, "I must find some poetic figure." And he spread his heavy fingers in the air as though a metaphor were tangible. I watched him. "Look at the garbage of this city," he said finally, and his fingers indicated the flying street. "All of the garbage in the city? Where do they take it?" "I don't know where they take it, but it might as well be my room." "It's much more likely," I said, "that they dump it into the Seine." But I sensed when I woke up and looked around the room the bravado and the cowardice of his figure of speech. This was not the garbage of Paris, which would have been anonymous. This was Giovanni's regurgitated life. Before and beside me and all over the room, towering like a wall, were boxes of cardboard and leather, some tied with string, some locked, some bursting. And out of the topmost box before me spilled down sheets of violin music. There was a violin in the room, lying on the table in its warped, cracked case. It was impossible to guess from looking at it whether it had been laid to rest there yesterday or 100 years before. The table was loaded with yellowing newspapers and empty bottles, and it held a single brown and wrinkled potato in which even the sprouting eyes were rotten. Red wine had been spilled on the floor. It had been allowed to dry, and it made the air in the room sweet and heavy. But it was not the room's disorder which was frightening. It was the fact that when one began searching for the key to this disorder, one realized that it was not found in any of the usual places. For this was not a matter of habit or circumstance or temperament. It was a matter of punishment and grief. I do not know how I knew this, but I knew it at once. Perhaps I knew it because I wanted to live. And I stared at the room with the same nervous, calculating extension of the intelligence and of all one's forces which occur when gauging a mortal and unavoidable danger, at the silent walls of the room with its distant, archaic lovers trapped in an interminable rose garden, and the staring windows, staring like two great eyes of ice and fire, and the ceiling which lowered like clouds out of those which fiends have sometimes spoken and which obscured but failed to soften its malevolence behind the yellow light, which hung like a diseased and undefinable sex at its center. Under this blunted arrow, this smashed flower of light, lay the terrors which encompassed Giovanni's soul. I understood why Giovanni had wanted me and had brought me to his last retreat. I was to destroy this room and to give Giovanni a new and better life. This life could be my own, which in order to transform Giovanni's must first become a part of Giovanni's room.